makes us scream. Andy Moan, now whoa, 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 Andy, whoa, silver stream, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Bruce Gunther. He's the adjunct curator of special exhibitions at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. Bruce is talking about a show of prints by Helen Frankenthaler, which runs through March 24th at the Oregon Jewish Museum in Old Town. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Bruce.
It's always a pleasure, Joseph. I love the KBOO audience.
Helen Frankenthaler was an abstract expressionist painter. She was from the Upper East Side, quite privileged background, but at a very young age broke through into the world of abstract expressionists as a second generation. This show is all prints. So she developed, 10 years into her career, developed her own interest in print and really blew it out of the water, changed so many things. So you're focusing just on prints here, but just tell the listeners a little bit about Helen Frankenthaler.
Helen Frankenthaler was one of three daughters of Alfred Frankenthaler, who was a very well-known and respected state Supreme Court justice in New York. She was educated at Dalton School and graduated from there at age 16. Her art teacher at Dalton, because it was one of those private schools in New York, was Rufino Tamayo, the great Mexican painter who was living in New York and was teaching high school art to kids from the Upper East Side of New York. And so she had her first taste of art at the hands of one of the magic realist and great colorist of the Mexican art scene. He taught her the basics of how to make a serious canvas and with clean corners and how to mix paint and how you layered in a traditional painting. And so she went from there, she discovered her passion for art. And she went to Bennington College.
Where's that?
Upper Vermont. And she studied at Bennington College with Paul Feeley, who was an important teacher of many people, it turns out, over the course of his career. But for her was a great mentor who opened her eyes to both the logistics and the vocabulary of painting, the physical nature of how you build a painting from the ground to the field to the image, through the veins of someone who understood cubism. And he used cubism as a starting point rather than traditional realism. And that's important because her vocabulary as a young person developed inside the core of modernism. It didn't begin with the beginning of time at Lascaux through the Romans to the French Academy. It began with cubism, the reinvention of pictorial space and the acknowledgement that painting is an illusion. It is a flat surface. So, you know, she has the chance to then live inside a vocabulary from the beginning of her art study that was grounded in European modernism, as seen from a Mexican who studied in Paris, Tamayo, and Paul Feeley, who also studied in Paris briefly, but was convinced that cubism was the beginning of the new world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is important for her because, and for all of us who appreciate her work, because she came to understand the relationship between the mechanics of art and a process that liberated the mind or the literary world of symbolism, myth, and its source for 20th century art. You know, so she was ready to see surrealism. She could understand the grounding of the abstract painters of the New York School from her grade. So that's who Helen Frankenthaler was at the beginning of her career. She was a woman who didn't worry about finances. Her father had died at 11, left her a trust fund, which became hers at age 21. And so she was able to rent an apartment and rent a studio in New York when she came back from college.
Mm-hmm.
And fell into the world of the avant-garde, the Greenwich Village art scene,
mm-hmm.
the early days of loft living. She is an amazing figure in 20th century art. A woman who had the independence to define herself and to define her work. She starts as a painter. She creates a new way of seeing painting and a new way of painting physically. And that's where she sets the stage for all of her 60-year-long career as an artist. She changes the way paint is delivered to the canvas.
Mm-hmm. So she thinned it down and kind of made oil paint like watercolor in a way.
Yes, but she also used house paint and aluminum paint from the radiators, and all of it became a fluid extension of the arm, and it happened on unsized canvas. Traditional painting, you prepare the canvas with a ground. It's rabbit skin glue, and it's a layer of gesso, so you get a flat matte
like
white. And it's a surface that will not absorb. The paint stays on the surface. So then you lay in the field, which is the first layer of color in oil paint, and you build the painting up on the surface. What she did is she was a friend of Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning. She met them through her paramour at the time, Clement Greenberg. She became friends with these artists, became a collaborator. They respected and followed her painting. So she looked at Jackson Pollock working on the floor, and she thought, there is a way to break the tradition of the canvas, of this traditional step-by-step vocabulary of how to make a painting. And she began to thin paint, and she worked on the floor, but she was not going to be Jackson Pollock. I mean, Jackson Pollock is an aesthetic dead end. The people who paint No one could follow him. I mean, if you did, everyone would say, oh, trying to make a Jackson Pollock, are we, Ted? Too bad. I think it's been done. You know, so. But what she did is she saw her work as color, as the experience of color, not as it describes an apple, but as it embodies the feeling or the memory of an apple. And so she thins the paint, and she begins to pour the paint and move the paint while it's still liquid on the raw canvas. And so the paint is staining into the canvas. And for a couple of years, she's experimenting with this notion of how do you get the freedom of motion, of moving pigment around, and the give meaning to the abstraction that's created. She moves into pure abstraction, and by redefining the way the paint happens, the painting happens, the structure of how you get the paint on the canvas, and in her case, in the canvas, changes the nature of paint and painting as a whole. And it changes everyone's idea of what a painting can be. Jackson Pollock animated painting as dance, as a physical act. Helen Frankenthaler takes painting as an emotional reality. How do I create the essence of the landscape I'm looking at
mm-hmm.
through my arms? And when you pour paint, you can't draw a tree trunk. You can't draw a table edge. What you do is create a space, the illusion of space on a two-dimensional form, as a physical color. And that color transmits clues that suggest experience. The ambiguity of space and the ambiguity of memory. So she is taking these literary notions that are afoot in the world in the mid-century America and Europe, the influence of surrealism as the space between the intellect and the emotional psychic world, and gives it form that is not an image, but a process that develops it. So when she's invited to make prints in 1961, there's a famous and important print studio, the Universal Limited Art Editions, started by an immigrant woman, Titania Grossman, who spends 2 years trying to convince Frankenthaler that she should leave her studio for a period of time to make a print, a lithograph. Because several of her friends, Grace Hartigan and Larry Rivers, and were making prints with her, they sort of helped convince her. So she says, okay, I'll come out. And so she comes out and she's faced with this 4-inch thick slab of limestone, very hard, dense. That's the traditional matrix for making a print. And a pot of touche, which is a viscous black material that dries on the print, that becomes the core for making the image happen. And a pile of black greasy crayons, which are also like touche. So it's an oil and water thing to make a lithograph, you know. And so she discovers that she can pour the touche as she does, and she can manipulate it as she does the color laying on the canvas, but it's all black. And so the disconnect in making prints was that she wasn't responding to the red, because it was a step away. Mm-hmm. So she makes this form. And she says, she picks a color, blue, mm-hmm. and this is the first stone in the exhibition.
Yeah, the print called The First Stone.
Yes.
Is her first print.
Is her first print, and it is this, it's where she first discovers how, what the process of making a print is, and how she can change it to mirror her studio practice as a painter. And it's a successful integration of how she must work as an artist to realize her vision, and what the process to create an edition print is. She's told, this is the way we have to do it, and she says, I'm not sure, let's try that. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly it's a rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And she takes this print studio out of their comfort zone, and she begins to use face tissue and a broom and her fingers and her elbow at one point to mm-hmm. erase something on the stone. And the master printer is going, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so. And she says, oh, let's just try. See if you can make this print. And she's working away mm-hmm. in this very direct way. And so they make the print, they print it, and they don't make the print first, they print the first stone. And they print it in blue, and she says, I think the blue has to be a little darker. Can I make this part light? And they say, well, maybe if you... She said, I'll just take some sandpaper. And she starts sanding on the limestone stone, which is not very effective. But what it did is it muted it, and suddenly they got a half tone. And the guy says, well, okay, we'll try it again. And so she develops a process that is hers alone, that validates the spontaneity of her expression and provides a vehicle for it to translate into something that is hidebound by tradition mm-hmm. and slow to act. And so, boom, there's this sense of the moment, the spontaneity of a drawn line as she uses the crayon to scribble in a shape, and then you add that in red to the blue. And then she comes back in the third round to create a black stone that is black. And she makes another shape and then integrates, and they layer them. She rips part of it off and says, I want it here. And so they keep modifying the stones to reflect what she's inventing on the proof sheet. And so then the next step, and they go through a week's worth and a ream of paper trying to figure out where she's going to go. And then finally she signs up, this is what it's going to be. and it prints it, and suddenly it's the same voice as her paintings. It's the same, we'll say imagery, because abstract art has imagery, but it's a gesture, a line, a form, a shape. And there it was. And so she said, oh, I think I'll make some more. And so she begins her journey in printmaking. Mm-hmm. So for over 40 years, from 1961 until 2010 is her last print, I think, mm-hmm. which is in
died
the...
Died in 2011.
Yeah. So, and the last print is in the exhibition, a woodcut, actually, called Japanese Maple. And it's very different. Mm-hmm. To see First Stone is open as if, you know, it's a sky or it's the reflections on an ocean somehow. It's these wonderful shapes, five colors, and a lot of the white paper showing. Japanese Maple, like her paintings, is like a river flowing of color. And it's these wonderful magentas and reds and deep, almost black purples, and it describes the shoots of a maple as it unfolds, that are red, and then there's a sharp green and a sharp blue shape that animate it. But the entire sheet of paper has been covered in ink and color. Just as her paintings of that period were, there was no raw canvas showing any longer. They'd mm-hmm. become a completely painted surface and very thick.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Bruce Gunter. He has curated the show Helen Frankenthaler, which is on now at the Oregon Jewish Museum through March 24th. Everyone should check out Madame Butterfly. It's very big. And to me, it looks like three sheets of plywood veneer. It's wood grain with lots of colors on it, but it's not actually plywood veneer, right? That's a
no.
print of plywood.
Yeah, what she did, it's a almost 7 foot long, 3 foot wide print. There are three sheets of paper. Two of them were a light sienna colored, and one of them was a slightly darker sienna colored paper. So the paper itself has a physical color. She created wood blocks that were made from different woods, cherry, elm, and a birch. And no, luan, cherry, and birch. They print the surface texture of the block itself onto the paper. They print the background color. It's all artifice. But she did the original painting on the wood block. And then they decided that that's what they were going to do. So Madame Butterfly is considered her most important print in the print world and is among the 10 most important prints in the 20th century. It broke ground for its use, integration of Western woodblock printing and ukiyo-e, Japanese-style woodblocks, two different styles of cutting, two different ways of thinking about how they're inked, how they're put on. It includes some pochoir, which is stenciled color. It includes screen printing on one part of it. It is an abstract image of a floating shape across these three different backgrounds, as if one were looking through a scrim into some kind of space that's not quite clear. Every time I see that print, I'm moved by the gathering of this, the energy of this purple shape in the midground and the way it lifts into a very kind of triangular white space that has its reach like hands reaching away from the body in these fingers of an opaque white that becomes transparent as it moves to the center, and then it becomes pink and lavender as it comes down. It's a very sensual picture. Mm-hmm. It's as if a kimono was opening onto a body, mm-hmm. and yet it's also a landscape.
How many colors?
102 colors.
Does that mean there's 102 passes on printing on the one piece of paper?
It turns out, because of the way it can happen, there are probably 57 passes, because there it's possible with a woodcut to isolate a patch of color on a block, and you could be printing two colors from one plate, or three colors, but there it's an overlaying of a watercolor based inking and a traditional Western opaque ink. And so that's part of what you're seeing are the translucent inks that reveal an image that was laid down before, that creates a third tone. And so the colors add up that way. But there were 102 colors used to start that printmaking. Mm-hmm. And it took 3 years to make that print.
Hmm.
To go through her process, which is she starts with a sketch to think about it that she develops in the room, and then she starts making the choices about how to pursue it, and testing blocks, they cut blocks, she changes them. She was very good about using a jigsaw. She learned to use one of these hand jigsaws. And when she did etching plates, which are metal plates, she could cut out shapes in the etching plate. And with Madame Butterfly, she cut out the wood block that had just been cut in a month-long process by a Japanese woodcut. So she cuts out a shape and puts it over here, and then she takes this other part. And so, and he's stoic, but I am sure he was appalled that she would chop up the plate. And then they would start testing it. And so it took that evolution of plates, printing, layering, changing, and making notes. She is so demanding about the resolution of the registry of all the parts, very important to her.
How they line up,
you see, because when you're using multiple stones, multiple silk screens, multiple wood blocks, they have to, the colors meet at a certain point. There can't be a gap and there can't be an overlap. And so that depends on how the plates are aligned on the print. So she's standing there, breathing down the neck of the master printer during this process, because she doesn't want, if she doesn't want that overlay, which creates a third tone or a third value, it has to touch but not press. And so it's an exacting science, which appealed to her, because everything had to be inside of her construct intellectually, and then the physical reality had to reflect the spontaneity of the generation. So how do you make something that is by its form fixed, voice the vision of spontaneity, the trill of a voice is what she tries to do in color,
mm-hmm.
on the page. And so it becomes poetic and lyrical at its best,
mm-hmm.
sensual and revealing, exacting and free form. It's those contradictions between one and the other that animate both her painting and her printmaking, which fed each other and mirror each other. And one of the things I tried to do in this exhibition is to create a survey of her prints that reveals the dynamic of her evolution as a painter. Because unlike, often prints in the American print renaissance, which the 60s, 70s, and 80s were about the prints becoming a mainstream avant-garde activity once again. It hadn't been before. It was always an illustrator's form. Or with Baskin, it was a political dialectic in woodblock particularly. But it is a form that can lag behind the painting. But with Frankenthaler, it's right in the moment she's creating. So what she was doing in the studio the week before on canvas, when she comes into the print atelier, it's still the spirit that's filling her, and so she makes it, and it is on paper what she is creating on canvas or paper in the studio with a brush or a mop or her hand. And that I think is important when someone comes in.
These are 17 prints. These are 17 Helen Frankenthaler prints out of 75 that Jordan Schnitzer's Foundation owns?
Yeah, the prints come from the Jordan D. Schnitzer Family Foundation. It's a national resource for printmaking in the modern era. The
seems contemporary. Like half the shows in Oregon are from Jordan Schnitzer.
Yes,
right
well,
now.
Because it's like one of the best, you know, lending libraries I know. You can go in and there is a chance he will have work by an artist you're interested in and a chance to create an exhibition. And he invites curators all the time to come and see the work and to present ideas for shows. So when I went to him, I knew the Frankenthalers that he owned, and I reviewed all of them and selected an exhibition that could meet our criteria here at the museum for an exhibition that reveals the breadth and the depth of an artist's expression through the prints medium. And so these all come from Jordan's collection, and they represent, in the show, there are four or five of the most important prints she ever created that come, and they're in beautiful condition. And so it's a symbiotic relationship.
Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful show. You know, it's just so sensuous, the colors and the sort of pooling liquid shapes. It's a nice change from everything else.
Well, yes, and I mean, I think what she gave, you know, what Helen Frankenthaler is probably one of the most important artists in America in the 20th century. And certainly when you use gender as a base, and often she is, you know, I can say quite clearly, she's the most important woman artist of the 20th century in America. She changes the nature of painting. She creates and revitalizes woodblock as a serious medium for contemporary artists. You know, all the people who follow her and do work, from Kiki Smith to Jasper Johns to the latest invention coming out of the art schools, owe a debt to Helen Frankenthaler for changing how prints are seen and made, how the vocabulary evolves in the freedom that she brought to it.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Bruce Gunter. He's the adjunct curator of special exhibitions at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education in Old Town. Bruce is talking about Helen Frankenthaler, which is a collection of prints, and the exhibit is on through March 24th, 2024. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus in person again, Bruce.
Always a pleasure, Joseph. Thank you.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hand him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart.